This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
My chance to talk with artists and writers, policymakers and performers, to hear their stories, what inspired their creations, what decisions changed their careers, and what relationships influenced their work. Billy Joel's fans have gotten to know him quite well over the past 4 decades.
Don't go changing to try and please me. You never let me down before.
From the open-hearted declarations of old-fashioned love in She's Got a Way and Just the Way You Are to the hard-rocking social commentaries We Didn't Start the Fire and Allentown.
Well, we're living here.
If, like me, you grew up listening to Billy Joel's music, you can chart phases of your life by each of his albums. Maybe that's because Billy Joel's songs are so passionately connected to who he was at the time he wrote them.
Check, check, 1, 2, 2. Can I get more level? Hello, hello, hello.
And when you're actually sitting in the same room as him with a piano nearby, well, you can't help yourself. I want you to play me something, if you don't mind. Because your fans would demand that. I mean, I still always remember you said that to me years ago, how predictable it was, wherever you were, that there was a piano. People were always like, Billy, could you, do you mind?
Right.
Just a couple of songs.
Right. It's his birthday, you know.
It's Christmas, and we were wondering if you could play.
Right. There it is.
It's,
and it's tuned.
Hello?
We just had it tuned.
We just
for you.
We're such fans.
Yeah. You don't mind, right?
That's your life.
Yes. But it's you know, it's fun. You can't have act-alongs. You're an act. You can't act-along.
No.
But you can have sing-alongs. I can always sit down at a party, play the piano, and everybody starts singing. Like, go to a pub in England. Hey, come on, Billy, give us a couple of songs. Come on, there you go. Yeah, it's Uptown Girl. And they all sit around and they sing, and everybody has a blast. It's fun. It creates a community instantly.
Billy Joel is the third best-selling solo artist of all time in the United States, where he sold more records than The Stones, Bruce Springsteen, and Madonna. But he admits there's still room for improvement.
I know what good piano playing is, and I'm not good. My left hand is lame. I'm a two-finger left-hand piano player.
As opposed
to somebody who knows what they're doing with their left hand.
Right.
I never practiced enough to use all my fingers on my left hand, so I just play octaves, bass notes. My right hand tries to compensate for my left hand being so gimpy, so I overplay on my right hand. My technique is horrible. I can't read music. I never really got...
You don't read music?
I used to, but I don't anymore. I forgot how.
So if I took a piece of music that you didn't know, if I got a score...
I wouldn't.
And I put it in front of you and said, play this, you would not...
It would be Chinese.
It would be Chinese to you.
Yeah, I don't know.
How did that happen?
I started taking lessons when I was about 4 or 5, and I went up till I was about 16. So it was almost 12 years of classical piano lessons. I loved it, but I just, when you become a teenager, everything changes. I didn't want to read other people's dots anymore. Mm-hmm. And I also realized early on, I'm not going to be a concert pianist. I don't have the Rachmaninoff hands, the Horowitz hands. I had strong hands, but the short fingers.
You had Johnny Friendly's hands.
Who's Johnny Friendly?
From On the Waterfront.
Oh,
you
okay.
You were a union boss doing the shape up down at the dock in Hoboken.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not.
He was my brother.
Right.
You should have taken better care of me, Charlie.
Yeah, you should have looked out for me, Charlie. Just a little bit.
A little bit.
And, so what did I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. I'm a bum, Charlie. Let's face it. That's what I am.
That's what I am. So you're a kid. Was there an intimation in your household?
There was a piano.
Classical music, right.
My father
classical
was,
music.
Yeah, he was a classically trained pianist. He grew up in Nuremberg, Germany. He also went to school in Switzerland. His father was quite well off. They had a mail order textile business, Joel Macht Fabrik. So he had to learn to play the piano. It was a very musical family. He could play Chopin. He could play all the great stuff. He should have become a musician. He became an engineer. He worked for GE, and then he was in promotion. But he was never really happy because he didn't become a musician. We had an old upright piano in the house, a Lester piano, real piece of junk. It ended up being a planter in the garden. My mom used it to grow honeysuckle. She sang. Her family were all singing, Gilbert and Sullivan, English music hall people.
So I grew up in a very musical home. I heard music all the time. My father was playing. My mother would sing. Radio was always on, listening to Milton Cross
and the opera on Sunday. Yes. Leonora enters wearing a white gown.
So I used to bang on the piano. My mom got sick of hearing me bang, and she dragged me down the street, and I started taking lessons. And I took to it.
Now, where was the family when your father was there and the piano? Where were you, you and the Lester and your mother and your father, where is this, the Bronx?
This is in Hicksville. My family moved with me out of the Bronx when I was a baby, I think right. Maybe a year old.
So you basically grew up on the island.
I grew up on the island in the Levittown section of Hicksville.
Right.
We had a Levitt house in Cape Cod on a quarter acre. Everybody's house looked the same. Started out looking the same.
Right.
Now it doesn't look anything like Levittown.
Right. Like my town, yeah. 16 years old, Hicksville, Long Island.
Yeah.
Vietnam War going on.
Yes.
You know, very, very tumultuous times. And all of a sudden, what do you decide you want to do?
Well, I joined a band when I was 14. I was asked to be in a band.
The Echoes?
This was the Echoes.
Right.
Garage band. All guitars, because there really were no keyboards that you could amplify. I played the piano. I never played the organ. Finally figured out how to amplify keyboards. I think the Dave Clark Five was the first band that had an organ you could hear, a Vox organ. It was cool.
I'm in pieces, bits and pieces.
Remember, I'm feeling glad all day. It's the most unglad sounding song in the world.
He was constipated. He felt that.
Yeah.
So you amplify the keyboard.
We got an organ, they decided I had the best voice in the band, which isn't really saying much because nobody could sing all that well in the band. We couldn't even harmonize. We're very bad singers. But they decided, you either got the best voice, you'll sing the songs. Okay.
How did you feel about that?
I felt a little funny about it because I'm not a front man where you stand with the mic. Like Mick Jagger, I didn't have the Mick Jagger moves.
Right.
I had a keyboard. You're kind of locked in. You can't move around. You can't carry a keyboard around unless you're an accordion player, and that looks like Lawrence Welk. Avant, then, the two. So I stood at the piano, or I sat at the piano, and but then I realized, you know, that girl I always had a crush on is actually looking at me. She never looked at me twice all those years in school, and we're playing at the Holy Family Church, the church dance. I was about 15. Virginia is looking at me. You know, come out, Virginia, that Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
And the band sounded great. I love what I was doing. The crowd went yay when we finished every song. And at the end of the night, the priest gave us each $15, which in 1965 was $1,500.
Right.
That was it. The door locked behind me.
Right.
This is what I'm going to do. I don't want to go to Carnegie Hall anymore. And I ended up going to Carnegie Hall anyway.
And what music were you performing? Covers of other people?
Jukebox bands. We were playing early Beatles, Stones, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs.
And during that time, when you're seeing Tommy James and the Shondells and all that music, who were you saying to yourself, I want to have his career?
Well, I liked a lot of different kind of music. I already came out of a classical background, and I really dug jazz when I was in my early teens. Dave Brubeck, Oscar Peterson, Art Tatum, Jimmy Smith, Bill Evans. I loved jazz.
Yeah.
But I realized I ain't going to be one of those guys either.
Why?
Because I wasn't a good enough pianist. I mean, these guys are as virtuistic as the classical.
Virtuistic as a religion, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, as a religion. No, I'm kidding. They're good. They're just good.
They're just really good. I mean, the top of the line guys are the top of the line in classical and jazz. They could have gone either way. The top of the line classical guys, had they decided to be jazz guys, could have been just as good as the top jazz guys and vice versa. But I was good enough to play rock and roll and pop. But what I really fell in love with as a teenager with girls and stuff was, first I liked soul music. James Brown, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, The Temptations.
Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, Gladys Knight. I mean, I just loved soul.
Did you cover that music as well?
I tried to.
You didn't want that in Hicksville?
Well, it was all, you know, they were all white people.
Yeah, exactly.
And there weren't
Long Island white
there
people.
Wasn't anybody but white people in my school. I think there were a couple of Jews, some Latinos. That was sprinklings, but everybody was white. But everybody liked soul music, Twist and Shout, what everybody would do, come on now, shout, come on now.
Yeah.
And Louie, I think that was the Kingsman, What I Say, Ray Charles. See the girl all dressed in green? And you'd make up really dirty words to that.
Sure.
We came up with some really good stuff. So I loved that stuff. And then the Beatles came around, and there it was. Boom. four working class guys from Liverpool, right, which is as close to Levittown in England, I think, sounding anyway.
Yeah.
That, okay, if four guys from Liverpool.
I never thought of that. Levittown is our Levittown, Liverpool.
Yeah, Liverpool. It's possible. It's possible. They don't look like Frankie Avalon. They don't look like Bobby Rydell. They look like four working class guys from anywhere. They could be from Hicksville. They could be from Levittown.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, that's possible. That's what I want to do. I want to write my own songs. I want to play in my own band, do our own arrangements, and make our own way.
When did that start?
This is before the Echoes.
Before?
Before I joined the band. The Beatles came out.
So you were a kid.
I was a kid. I was 13.
And you started writing music?
Yes. I started writing Ersatz Beatles songs.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Well, I'd climb the highest mountain.
Yeah.
And
I want to hold your purse.
Like that, yeah.
I want to hold your purse.
Yeah, trying to sound Liverpoolian.
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 Yeah.
You know? She don't love me like before. My own song. She don't love me anymore. I believed all the lies she told me. You know, that kind of thing. Trying to sound like the early Beatles. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I was asked to join a band after the Beatles came out. Now, you got to remember, November of 63, John F. Kennedy is assassinated. The country goes into the dumps. Even though we didn't know that much about politics or government, he was our guy. He was the young, vigorous, progressive, and he was, boom, he was shot, taken away. Everybody just turned off, like a switch turned off. We became very cynical. The whole nation had the blues. February of 64, who comes out? The Beatles come to America.
Right.
We took them in. We just embraced
like oxygen.
That. They walked into that space.
Hopeful, funny.
It was. They were
warm,
you're
sexy.
Our guys.
Yes.
Everything. Everything
let's
that was
party.
Taken away from us. Great. Let's go have a party.
Let's party.
Yep.
So you start writing songs, and you're saying Ersatz Beatles songs. What's the first song you write that you can remember?
It was called "My Journey's End."
Right.
I could play it if you want me to.
Let's hear it.
I'd climb the highest mountain and I'd swim the deepest sea. If I knew you were there at my journey's end, waiting for me,
waiting
well,
for
I
me.
Could tell how much that you love me,
waiting
by
for
the
me.
Letters that you send.
Journey's end.
I'd go anywhere,
end of the
if
journey.
I knew you were waiting there at my journey's end.
What's the first song you wrote? What's the first song which was one that you wrote?
Well, it was probably in The Hassles.
The Hassles sold records?
A few. On Long Island, probably.
Right.
Maybe Jersey.
Right, exactly.
We went
on the turnpike.
Overseas.
Yeah, at the Woodrow Wilson rest stop.
Yes. I think it was the coffee chock full of nuts in Paramus because we opened it. Hassles played at the opening. The first time we sold anything, see, I was signed originally with the Echoes to Mercury Records, and we changed the name to the Lost Souls. We were the Lost Souls for a while. We made a couple of records. Nothing ever happened. What was the other one? She don't love me like before. She don't love me anymore. I believed all the lies she told me. Don't you know it's true that she stole me away from my true love, and now my new love doesn't love me anymore. Almost like Mr. Blue.
Yeah, that's like the Beatles.
And then we became the Lost Souls. Then it turns out there was an English band called the Lost Souls, so we had to change our name. So the president of Mercury Records, brilliant guy at the time, said, okay, we're going to give you a new name, the Commandos.
Right.
Vietnam was he
sure.
at the time.
Yeah.
You're going to be the Commandos. Ugh, we hate that name. Nobody likes, you know.
War.
Yeah, nobody likes that stuff.
Right.
No, you're going to be the Commandos. It's going to be great, and we're going to get you outfits. And so that lasted about 15 minutes, and we got dumped off the label.
So it's Echoes.
Echoes, Lost Souls.
Lost Souls.
And then
Commandos. For a weekend.
For a weekend.
They opened up one quick chock full of nuts.
And then there was a band on Long Island which was making a lot of local noise called The Hassles. They asked me to join. The guys in my band, the Echoes, the Lost Souls, Commandos, whatever, they were all going on to either the military or college. None of them were really seriously going to be musicians, except the bass player. And I said, I'll join the Hassles. They wanted me to play organ. I'll join the, if I can bring my bass player with me, because they didn't have a bass player. They said, okay. So that became the Hassles. And then there was another guy, he got a lot of Mick Jagger moves, Little John, his name was.
Little John. He's
a fun guy, great hair, good looking guy, couldn't sing to save his ass.
Didn't matter.
He jumped,
you could wiggle it,
he was gorgeous, and women just went nuts. Exactly. And I'm in the back doing
women
all
were
singing.
Deaf.
Well, they had eyes, you know.
they could see.
They could see the music. So,
video killed the radio star.
Oh, absolutely. Glad I came up in an era where it wasn't that prevalent.
Exactly.
So then I was in the Hassles. Now, the Hassles were a band, Blue White Soul band. There were a bunch of them. The Vagrants was another one. They used to play at the Action House all the time in Long Island. We made two albums with United Artists, and they both bombed out. But that's the first time we started selling anything. Every Step I Take was the first song that I wrote that actually sold something. That was the Vamp. Everything I do, na 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 na. I don't know. The chorus went, every step I take, every move I make, I know I'm trying to do a knife without you. I turn, I run, I hide, really bad lyrics. When I know deep inside, a part of me has died.
You sound like Papa.
Yeah.
I didn't know you wrote that. That's great.
That's how my father used to talk. It sounded like Popeye. Yeah, so that was probably the first thing that sold. It was on the first Hassles album. I think we sold, I don't know, a dozen copies. But our big single was actually a cover of a Sam and Dave record. You Got Me Hummin'. You Got Me Humming. It was a big song by Sam and Dave. Everybody was covering soul records and doing them psychedelic or doing their own arrangements of them. That was the Hassles' hit. First album was horrible, but the second album was really horrible. And then me and the drummer split off from the Hassles to form a power duo.
Yeah.
We were going to destroy the world with amplification. Yeah. This was like the heavy metal thing. We heard Zeppelin. It blew our minds.
Iron Butterfly.
In the Garden of Vida, honey, don't you know that I love you?
Yep.
Yeah.
Went on and on and on.
So when you get to this point where you say couple albums, the Hassles, and then when is it you?
Well, the bands got smaller and smaller and smaller. Attila became a two-man band.
So when you and he went off,
we went off.
Attila was the two of you.
Attila was just the two of us.
And what did he play?
He played drums.
Drums.
I played Hammond organ wired directly through amplifiers.
So we're getting closer to Lawrence Welk now, the more we go. It's getting closer.
Well,
you almost got that accordion.
But it was louder. Yeah. It was much louder. And we got signed to Epic. And we were on Epic for one album, and it was a colossal failure. We played one gig. I think it was on Ungano's on the west side in Manhattan. And people went fleeing from the place. We were so loud. You could see blood coming out of people's ears. It was horrible. Thank God it didn't happen, because I would have screamed myself right out of the business.
So after you nearly kill a room full of people at Ungano's,
yes.
Then what happens?
Then we broke up, and I decided I no longer want to be a rock and roll star. Got that out of my system. I was about 19 or 20. I want to write songs now.
Coming up, how this kid from Long Island adjusted to life in Los Angeles.
Chicks coming in with bikinis and stuff from the beach.
Rubbing your neck and shoulders while you're playing.
Yeah, that's what it looks like in the movies.
And why, even so, he was able to say goodbye to Hollywood. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Billy Joel never set out to be a rock star. He just wanted to write songs like this one.
Baby, all the lights are turned on you. Now you're in the center of the stage.
And sometimes he heard his songs in a voice other than his own.
Baby, all the lights are turned on you.
Now you're in the center of the stage. Everything revolves on what you do. You're in your prime, you've come of age.
Did you send him that song to record?
I wanted him to, but right. Bob writes his own stuff. He's not going to do covers.
Yeah. He doesn't buy songs from other people.
No, he does not. But I no longer wanted to be the guy on stage. I wanted to be the guy behind the scenes. This just happened to coincide with the era of the singer-songwriter.
Right.
Harry Chapin, Jim Croce, James Taylor was huge at the time.
Yeah.
So the advice I got was, well, you want people to hear these songs, why don't you make your own album? Okay, I got a record deal, Family Records, a guy named Artie Rip. Perfect name. I was like Pinocchio. You know, I fell in with the, hi, diddly-dee, an actor's life for me, for those people. And I recorded an album in L.A. I lived in L.A. for a little while. They said, okay, you made the album. Now you got an album. You need to promote it. You need to go on the road and play and promote the album. I said, oh, okay. It's kind of a strange way to be a songwriter, but that's what other people were doing. You know, other people would be interested in my material if I promoted it, promote the album, they'll hear it. Well, the album was mastered at the wrong speed. So a song like this. She's got a way about her. I don't know what it is, but I know that I can't live without her. I played like this.
She's got a way about her. I don't know what it is, but I know that I can't live without her.
So if you hear that recording, I sound like the Chipmunks.
Well,
speed it up.
Kind of, yeah.
Oh, it's terrible.
Kind of.
The album never went anywhere. Nothing happened. And I went on the road, and I promoted it, and never saw it in the stores. But that was when I was me. That was just Billy Joel.
So when people buy that album, that album's been re-released where it's not at that speed.
It's been remastered, but it's still, there's something wrong with it. It just doesn't sound right. I would advise people, don't buy it. Okay. If you can steal it, steal it.
Right. So Cold Spring Harbor is the first album. It's you. How many band members? You?
Guitar, bass, drums. And there were some violins that were put in by Artie Rip. He was trying to be Phil Spector. It got all glopped up. It was supposed to be more of a folky album.
You recorded that in L.A.?
Recorded it in L.A.
How long were you in L.A.?
3 years.
Well, what was that like for you?
Weird.
Yeah. How?
I went there, and I stayed on Santa Monica Boulevard. It's this dumpy little place called the Tropicana Motel, right there on Santa Monica.
Where Duke's Coffee Shop was.
Yeah. And they made the huge sandwiches for the poor
sure.
musicians.
You used to have breakfast at Duke's.
It was great.
Yeah.
You a buck, you could eat like a king.
Yeah.
The place was a dump, but the postcards said the Tropicana, and it had like a palm tree on it. So I sent postcards to all my friends. Yeah. I've made it.
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm in Hollywood.
It's all coming together.
Tropicana.
Yeah, I'm having omelets on Santa Monica Boulevard for a dollar. I mean, they're playing my song at the Chipmunk speed.
Well, look,
but it's all going great.
Yeah, if you're from Long Island, you get a postcard with a palm tree on it.
Sure.
It says the Tropicana. It's, oh my God.
Yeah.
He's made it.
Yeah, because you and I are from the same background.
Yes.
I mean, I'm from South Shore, Long Island. Your friends you grew up with are probably like mine, where they probably get that postcard. They're like, Joey, come here. I got a postcard from Billy. He's at the Tropicana here.
Wow, he's on the beach with girls, like the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
He's driving cars.
When I would make movies, my friends would be like, they say, let me ask you a question. When you do a love scene with a broad in a movie, like, do you ever get excited, like yourself, you know what I mean? Is it weird, to make love to a woman in front of all them people?
Can you pick who you make out with?
Yeah, they're like, do you enjoy that? Was it fun?
You mean the groupies out there?
I'm like, no, it's not fun, because it's 125 people staring at you while you're doing it. They're like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I forgot.
We got those questions. What's it like in a studio? I mean, you like a lot of drugs and girls and stuff.
Yeah.
No, you're actually in a factory.
Yeah.
And you're surrounded by equipment, and you don't have time.
But you don't
for
have
it,
like so. Big fish tanks full of cocaine
you
and everything.
Like chicks coming in with bikinis and stuff from the beach,
rubbing your neck and shoulders while you're playing.
Yeah, that's what it looks like in the movies.
Yeah.
Did you meet any movie stars? I'm a musician. How am I going to meet movie
every night
stars?
You having dinner with who? All the big stars, right?
Right.
And a fish tank full of blow and chicks in bikinis rubbing your shoulders, right?
That's
every day and night.
That's what people think.
Now, when you did the Cold Spring Harbor there,
I did. Make
and did you do the there. Next album out there?
Actually, I got a job after. I did the Cold Spring Harbor album. I dropped that aside. I had to get out of this horrible deal that I'd signed. I signed away everything. Copyrights, publishing, record royalties, everything. My first child, I gave away it all. And I said that I got to get out of this deal. And I hid in L.A. And I worked in a piano bar under the name Bill Martin. This was down in the Wilshire District. And it was it's not a real bar town, L.A.
It's not.
Long Island is a pub on every corner.
Yeah.
It's a pub culture.
So when people close their eyes and they think of Piano Man, I think of a guy bending over a piano, and I think of a guy in a place on Long Island or in New York. But you recorded that out in Los Angeles.
I recorded it in L.A., and that's where I worked. Some people think I did it for years. I worked in this piano bar for 6 months. I needed to make some money.
Right.
I made union scale. I get tips. Mostly play the, you know, major seventh chords. Good evening. How you doing?
but how does Piano Man start? Right.
That kind of thing. You know, yeah. A guy in the hotel lobby. They would request songs. I didn't even know the song. Can you play, what's that Hoagy Carmichael song?
Stardust.
And I would go, sure. Can you play Misty? Sure. And everybody was drinking pretty
drunk,
heavy.
Yeah.
Because in an L.A. bar, these were all people who lost at the track. Losers. Oh. I just like drinking like fish. And I got free drinks. Oh, my God.
But so then you do Piano Man. Then what's the next album after that you do in L.A.?
We did Piano Man in L.A. And there was an album. That wasn't a hit album. People perceived that to be a hit. It was not a hit.
Piano Man.
But this is back in the early 70s. In those days, they still had FM progressive radio. Disc jockeys could spin whatever they wanted.
WLIR, Dennis McNamara.
That's it.
Remember him?
Yeah.
I was a kid home. I was smoking you-know-what, leaning out the window so my mom didn't know. And on the radio, we'd hear, WLIR, this is Dennis McNamara. Jackson Brown.
Right.
I listened to this guy. He was my childhood. Dennis McNamara.
We grew up with these disc jockeys at night. Allison Steele.
Allison
the
Steele.
Nightbird. Roscoe. Zachary was a disc jockey.
Vince Skelsa.
And my favorite guy was Scott Muni coming at you.
Scott Muni.
A little spooky tooth.
Yeah, right.
And now from England, spooky tooth. Scott Muni coming at you right now. They played whatever they wanted. They didn't have program directors. They didn't have consultants. And people would call in. If they got enough requests, they would play a track. So Piano Man got requested all the time. It was a five and a half minute record. I mean, it's not an AM hit amount of time. It's too long. And it was in three-quarter time. It's a waltz. And it's not really lyrics. They're limericks. John at the bar is a friend of mine. He gets me my drinks for free. He's quick with the joke. Got to light up your smoke with the sun. But he'd rather be. Could be one of the girl from Nantucket. Yeah. So it's still limericks. And if anybody said this was going to be a hit record, I'd tell them right out of their mind. The next album comes out, Street Life Serenade. It's the sophomore jinx. I did not have enough time to write new material after the Piano Man album came out. Piano Man made a lot of noise, got a lot of attention paid to it. Record company wanted another follow-up right away. Okay, new album now. I've been on the road. I haven't had a chance to write. No, we need it now. I didn't have any material, and you can hear it.
So what do you do? What do you do when you got nothing? What do you play?
I had nothing. I was empty. I was running on empty.
But there's not nothing on the album. Where'd that come from?
Well, I had one song that I thought
was
okay, The Entertainer, which is that... another folk song. I am the entertainer. I know just where I stand. Another serenader and another long-haired band. Today I am your champion. I may have won your hearts, but I know the game, you're forgetting my name. I won't be here in another year if I don't stay on the chart. I wrote it on the guitar, actually. But that was it. That was probably the one song that I had finished. And then, boom, I'm in the studio. The clock is ticking. So there's two instrumentals on that album. The Root Beer Rag, which is just a piano ragtime thing, and this ersatz Western movie theme called The Mexican Connection. Because I was living in L.A. I was fascinated with Westerns.
Mm-hmm. Bum, bum, bum.
That's it.
Bum, 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 bum. What are the songs
came
off of Street Life that were...
Nothing.
That were memorable.
Nothing.
The Entertainer were pretty.
Is the only one. There was a song about a hooker that I was in love with. I wanted her to leave her profession and be with me, but she made too much money and I couldn't afford her. It was called Roberta. What else was on that album? Souvenir. It's a nice song.
Up
picture postcard, a folded stub, a program of the play. File away the photographs of your holiday. And your momentum, and only like another 15 seconds of it. That was a nice song, but it was like this short. And other than that, there's the Mexican Connection, Root Beer Rag. It was okay.
And you finish Street Life and you're in LA, and then what do you do?
I finish Street Life and it comes out and it goes, nyaw, boom, dives right off the charts. The album after that was Turnstiles. I moved back to New York. I said, I'm going back to New York. Right. Mid-70s. New York was in the dumps. They were going to default.
Forward to New York, drop dead.
I saw that headline, and people in L.A. were like, ha, 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 screw New York. We can't wait till New York goes down the dumps.
Yeah.
And I said, the hell with that. If New York's going down the tubes, I'm going back. I want to be there for this. And I'm picturing this apocalypse. I actually wrote a song called Miami 2017.
Sure.
Thinking about the year 2017. I'm an old man. I'm telling my grandchildren. I was there. I saw the lights go out on Broadway.
Seeing the lights go out on Broadway. I saw the Empire State laid low, and life went on beyond the Palisades. We all bought Cadillacs and left there long ago.
And I'm picturing I'm an old man in the year 2017. And I'm living in Miami, which I'm closing in on now.
You and me both.
I'm kind of fulfilling my own prophecy here.
Yeah.
So, and the other song, which is.
Some folks like to get away, take a holiday from the neighborhood, have a flight to Miami Beach or to Hollywood. I'm taking a Greyhound on the Hudson River line. I'm in a New York state of mind.
Or we could do it like this.
Some folks like to get away. Tony, come on, chicken.
Take a holiday from the neighborhood.
Hop a flight
to Miami Beach or to Hollywood. Yeah.
I'm taking a Greyhound. That's right.
The Hudson River line.
Yeah.
I'm in a New York state of mind.
That's it. And he recorded it. And that was, I was hoping other people would do that song. But I was back in New York. I was home
again.
Are
you glad you were?
I was thrilled.
So leaving L.A., it just was meant to be.
I even wrote a song, home. Say Goodbye to Hollywood.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, say goodbye to Hollywood. Thanks, it's been great, but goodbye. After 3 years, it went sour on me. When I first moved out, the weather's great, and all the chicks and the palm trees. Well, after 3 years, everybody's full of crap here. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a producer. What? You know, we all produce gas. We produce something.
When you go back to New York, where do you go? The city?
I moved to Highland Falls, which is right up the Hudson.
Why?
We weren't ready to move Lock, Stock, and Barrel into the city. I was married at the time, my first ex-one.
Sure. Where's she from?
From Syosset.
Right. So she went out there with you and came back with
you? She went out there with me and came back with me. And this was, Turnstiles was recorded in New York. I produced it myself.
Are you glad you did?
I was glad I did at the time because I needed to use my own musicians. I didn't want to use session men. I didn't want to use studio players. I wanted my road band. It was a Long Island band, and we were doing great on the road. We weren't selling any records, but the crowds were going crazy. We were blowing headliners off the stage, the Doobie Brothers. Everywhere we played, the Beach Boys, we would get better applause than the
old. This is when Turnstiles came out?
Yes.
But Turnstiles sold records, didn't it?
No. Turnstiles didn't sell anything.
You got to be kidding me.
No hits. New York State of Mind is now perceived to be a hit, but it wasn't a hit. Say Goodbye to Hollywood wasn't a hit. None of the records.
God, I love all those songs.
Not until The Stranger, which was the next album in 77.
And off that comes how many hits?
Four.
Which were?
Just the Way You Are, Moving Out, Only the Good Die Young, and She's Always a Woman.
Right, so She's Always a Woman and Just the Way You Are love songs.
Well, She's Always a Woman is a love song, not perceived as a love song.
Well, I'm just saying, but they're very romantic songs.
Yeah. Well, I'd had romantic ballads before that. From Cold Spring Harbor, She's Got Away. Piano Man, If I Only Had the Words to Tell You, You're My Home. Mm-hmm. And then Turnstiles, Summer Highland Falls, no, it's a manic depression, but about a relationship. Mm-hmm. But I was writing ballads. I've Loved These Days.
Sure.
About a man and a woman. And then The Stranger, Just the Way You Are, which is just a pure out-and-out love song. She's Always a Woman, which is kind of a double-edged sword there. Mm-hmm. I had no idea it was such a big record. Just the Way You Are became this monster.
Like the Beatles.
Yeah.
So what's after The Stranger?
After The Stranger, we started playing coliseums and arenas, the big, big rooms. And I went right back on the road again, and I started writing again.
You start writing for bigger rooms?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah, I had to be. I was aware. Now we're playing the big places, yeah. And we got to write bigger songs. I got to have bigger
numbers.
Music. Energy.
Yeah.
You can't play to a coliseum with a handful of ballads.
No.
You got to knock them out. It got bigger. It got rounder, fatter.
Fuller,
faster. You know, more high energy stuff.
Harder, faster, deeper, as they say in the adult film industry.
Yeah, that was it, pretty much. Went into the triple X.
You started going triple X.
Yeah. Big shot.
More Billy Joel, raw but uncensored, after the break. You're listening to Here's the Thing, and you can hear more conversations.
Sing a song with me, Chris. Ready?
And okay, more singing with other artists, policymakers, and performers.
Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun.
Take a listen to earlier episodes at heresthething.org.
Okay, that's enough.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Billy Joel recorded 5 albums with a band that consisted of the same 4 guys: Liberty DeVito, Russell Javors, Doug Stegmeier, and Richie Cannata. Cannata left the band in 81. At that point, Joel was also ready to try something new.
I wanted to write my masterpiece, my Sgt. Pepper, as it were. Right. Instead of writing from the inside out, like starting with a seed of a song, we started with sound, ideas and thoughts and studio techniques, and we didn't really know what we had until almost the final mix. What is this thing? We're experimenting with stuff, and it took a year.
Were you still producing?
No.
Who was producing?
Phil Ramone, who started with Stranger, 1977.
Now, when you have someone like Ramone, what did he do for you? How did he help you?
Well, Phil Ramone, he was a child prodigy on the violin. He was from South Africa, actually. He knew music. And now, he had years and years in the trenches as an engineer. He recorded JFK speeches. When you see the Marilyn Monroe thing at Madison Square Garden.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
That's Phil Ramone.
Wow.
He was the engineer on those things. I mean, he's been with some amazing recordings, but never got credited as a producer. So who's this guy, Phil Ramone? I keep seeing Phil Ramone. Paul Simon used him as an engineer. And I said, I want to work with this guy because he looks like he knows what he's doing. He knows how to get good sound. He knows how to deal with sonic things. And when he came in, boom, we knew we had a professional guy. It was like working with another great musician. He knows how to play the studio like we know how to play our instruments. Everything changed. The band just rose to the occasion. We were having a blast.
So like a great producer, very often in films, like anywhere, anything, any creative enterprise, I find the people that are the most successful and talented producers are the ones who, although they may not be able to do it themselves, they know what you need to do.
They cut to what the synergy should be. They know what the dynamic should be in the studio.
Does he come to you and go, don't do that?
Yes.
That doesn't work. And you listen to him?
Yeah, I would listen to him. We tried it his way. It was mutual respect.
Right.
When we did Just the Way You Are, originally, the drummer was playing it like a cha-cha. Don't go change one to cha-cha-cha. And we hated it. I hate the song. Drummer couldn't figure out what to play. Phil actually told him, play a backwards samba. Boom. Da boom. Ba boom. Cha boom. Plataka. Boom. And it worked. It was like a backwards samba. What are we doing? We didn't know what we were doing. But Phil was right. I came in with the idea of playing Only the Good Die Young as a reggae. Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. The cat the liquor stop much too late. Liberty throws his sticks at me. He goes, why are you doing it? Because the closest you've been to Jamaica is Queens. What are you doing?
It's changing trains to go down to Seaford.
Change at Jamaica.
So for the train to Spionk.
That's it. He said, I'm not playing this. What are we going to do? So Phil came up with this shuffle against straight fours. And the guitars are going, banana, banana, bop, bop, banana. And we were playing it. And it worked. It was like two things jammed into each other. Phil knows how to do that. And when we would get tired or we get discouraged, he'd say, just stay. Stay a little longer. Try one more. All right, take a break. Let's have some Chinese. Okay? Go back in. The post-Chinese food tapes were always good. Right. I don't know why that was.
Yeah, that MSG, man. It gets right into the fingertips.
It worked.
Yeah. But think of where Mozart would have been if they had MSG back then.
Oh, wow. He did pretty good.
He did pretty good, yeah. He
40
did
symphonies.
Good. He went as far as you could go without MSG, I think.
Yes.
And then you do Nylon Curtain. That's 82?
82 was the Nylon Curtain.
And you said you wanted to be your Sgt. Pepper, and what was it?
It was, it's my favorite album. Really.
Why?
Because I could hear all the work that went into it, all the textures, all the layers.
What's a song that you're particularly fond of from that?
It's very obscure.
Don't get excited, don't say a word. Nobody noticed, nothing was heard. It was committed discreetly, it was handled so neat. And it shouldn't surprise you at all. You know, break all the records, burn the cassettes. I'd be lying if I told you that I had no regrets. There were so many mistakes, but what a difference it makes. And now it shouldn't surprise you at all.
No hits. Allentown was kind of a hit off that album.
I remember that, yeah.
Didn't really sell a lot of records.
What did you do after Nylon Curtain?
After the Nylon Curtain, because it was such an intensive labor, the Nylon Curtain, something very dense and very complex, I wanted to do something simple and dumb and happy.
Right.
And I did An Innocent Man,
right,
which is really an homage to all the music of my teenage years. Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons was Uptown Girl.
Right. And that was a hit.
It was a big hit.
Big hit.
It was a joke.
Right.
It was a Uptown Girl. I'm trying to sing like
exactly,
Frankie.
Exactly.
She been living in her uptown world. I bet she never had a backstreet guy. He had this impossibly high voice. Never told her why. I'm going to try you. And I realized something. You remember the song Ragdoll? And then the verse was, I love you just the way you are. Is that where I heard that before? Just the way you are.
Yeah.
And then there was a song, I was trying to do Little Anthony and Imperials. Didn't I say shoo-up? I wasn't ready for romance. Shoo-shoo-a. Didn't we promise we would only be friends? Ah. And so we danced, though it was only a slow dance. I started breaking my promises right there. And now you'll recognize the chorus because it goes like this. This night is mine. It's only you and I. Tomorrow is a long time away. This night can last forever, which is the Pathétique by Beethoven.
Right.
And I gave him credit on the back of it, L.V. Beethoven. So somebody, Billy's co-writing with somebody, L.V. Beethoven. I said, Beethoven, for crying out loud. But that was a fun album. I had met Christy. I had just gotten divorced from X1. And here I am meeting Whitney Houston,
sure,
when she was a model, Elle McPherson, I'm dating her, I'm dating Christy Brinkley. This is fantastic. I feel like I'm 16 years old again. Yeah. Going out
it's
with
going
girls.
Well.
It's all going great. And I'm a rock star.
Yeah,
I got a pad at the old San Moritz on Central Park South,
sure,
which is now, I think, the Ritz-Carlton. So this music was me being a teenager all over again, falling in love, having romance and all that great stuff.
So why'd you get married?
I don't know. You're asking me?
Exactly. Is that a part of your makeup, which is married, family? Was marriage the right thing to do?
I was madly in love. And
yeah, when you're really
like,
in love, you marry him.
That's it.
That's how I feel.
But I still feel like I can be madly in love and not be married.
Yes.
I was married 3 times.
When did you go to Russia?
87.
Right. And how did that happen?
Well, we played in Cuba in 1979. Played at the Karl Marx Theater in Havana. And everybody gets up on stage. These other American artists, Stephen Stills, Viva la Revolution, Viva Fidel. Chris Christopherson, Viva la Revolution, Viva Fidel. He's talking in Spanish. I get up on stage. I'm in the last act. I say, yo no hablo español. And I went to Big Shot. And the kids went, storm the stage.
There you go.
They don't want to hear Viva. We hear this crap all the time. We want to hear Big Shot.
Exactly.
I said, we got something going here. We're being subversive with rock and roll. This is what
I
like.
They loved you there.
They loved
How did that feel to you? What was the first place you played a big concert at? When you were a star, you're a big music star. You're one of the biggest music stars ever. And you go to a foreign country and you realize music just transcends all of it.
Germany. I think it was in Frankfurt.
What year?
77, 78. I played in England, and the English, they're kind of fickle. They like you for about a month, and then you're yesterday's papers.
Right.
Oh, we like that Billy Joel. But Germany, we had a couple of hits. And the Germans went berserk. They don't have seats. You're getting a standing ovation. When you walk on the stage, Billy. I'm thinking, oh, I guess they don't know what they did to my family. Yay, Billy. But I'm thinking, so this is how Adolf must have felt.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, wow, this
when they
is
love you, they let you know.
Wow. Ripping at my hands and tearing my clothes. This is great.
The trip to Russia in 87, was that your first time there?
First time ever in
and
Russia.
And how did they take to you?
It was the first time they'd ever had a major act from the West, America. People had gone there before but played with small PA systems and little private rooms. We played at the Lenin Stadium, the Olympic Stadium. And we brought a Western PA system, same PA system we'd use at Madison Square Garden. You know, the helicopters come in at the beginning of Good Night, and they're looking around for the helicopters. And then the hard rock is hitting and the drums, they started going berserk. There were security guards going around giving people sedatives because they thought they were having fits. The Cold War ended for me right then. This is still when Reagan was calling it the evil empire. And I said, we're not going to have a war with these people. They can't even get toilet paper right. You know, we're not going to fight with them. I don't want to fight them. They love us. Everywhere I went, Viva America. Long live America. This is great. Cold War ended. So I was thrilled that went the way it did.
Let me ask you a question. You're funny. Everything it takes to be an actor, you could have done. You never wanted to do that. Never.
I never was comfortable in front of a camera.
Really?
I became a musician because I never felt I was photogenic. I was never happy with how I looked. I was very comfortable in a studio. I'm very comfortable far away on a stage. Whenever there was a camera, it kind of destroyed what I was trying to create. It took away the imagination. I could look however I wanted. I could look like Cary Grant. But I saw it reduced to an image. I went, no, that's not who I am. Don't look at that guy.
Well, I always say acting is what you do when you have no musical ability. If I could do what you do, I would never do what I do.
That's what actors say. They want to be musicians.
I would never, ever, ever, ever waste 5 minutes of doing what I do if I could do what you do.
That's a lot of actors say.
Oh, yeah.
But you're so good at what you do. No, if I could do what you do.
Yeah, music is everything.
If I could sing, if I could play, if I could write.
A film or a television program, you have to make an appointment with that and watch that.
But
you can listen to music while you're jogging, while you're at the gym, while you're making love, while you're having dinner, while you're in the car. Mm-hmm. It can be the soundtrack to your life. All day long, if you want to.
In church.
Anywhere. Music is everywhere. Music is everything.
Right.
And acting is, like I said, what you do when you have no musical talents. So you got divorced the second time.
Yes.
And got remarried and divorced a third time.
Right.
And when you have these things happen, do you write songs about that?
No, I stopped writing songs about it when I got divorced the second time. That was in 93. Actually, 94, the divorce happened. The album River Dreams came out. And I realized, you know what? I'm spinning out the story of my life to all these strangers. I'm kind of sick and tired of everybody knowing my personal life and how I feel about this one and that one.
Did you resent that?
I didn't resent it. I just decided to clam up.
Right.
I feel like I've given away pieces of myself.
Sure.
Maybe something I should have given to the relationship. Right. I gave to the work.
Right.
It's all consuming. If you're going to do it right, you have to jump in with both feet and do it 100%. Music will do that. It was a very harsh mistress, music. You have to do it all the way. And maybe I didn't do things I should have done, or maybe I didn't take care of business the way I should have taken care of, because of the music. And so I stopped writing songs about my personal relationships, but I kept writing music. And after the third marriage didn't work, I tried marriage. It's, you know, three times. I tried it three times. I never gave up on it. I just realized this just doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't work.
Right. People don't appreciate how it's like to have a relationship in this business that works, you got to be really lucky, man. It's got to be so, it's so much luck, you know? Because like you said, the career is the mistress and you're out there working. Like I would look at my ex-wife or ex-girlfriends and I think, what would the alternative be? You want me to have no options and no work and I'm staying home all the time?
Yeah, but on the other hand, how much of you are they getting? If you're in a part, you take on the role, it doesn't come off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when work, most people leave their jobs. You have to be that character through the whole project. Now, when I'm writing, I mean, I've got to stay in harness. I've got to be that songwriter guy. I'm preoccupied. Maybe I should change that to a B flat. You know, that chord back, I'm obsessed with it. I wonder how much of me they're not getting because of that. I don't know if you were like that when you were doing a part.
I find that in film, it's different because film, you don't really have a chance unless you work with a tremendously intense group of people. Now, when I've done plays, it's different. Mm-hmm. When you do it well, you can sit back and you light up a cigarette and you're like, right. Well.
And we nailed that one.
Where I just write it down in the books. You really feel some satisfaction.
Yeah.
You feel that way when you perform?
When we perform, we got that.
When show.
We do a show.
Do you come off stage after a show and you sit there and go, well, there it is.
That was a good
Ladies and gentlemen, Billy Joe, that is ensemble.
They'll be talking about this for a few days. But we also know when we stunk.
Right.
We come over and go, that sucked.
Yeah, right.
Oh, we were terrible.
Please don't remember that one.
Right. Why did they applaud? You know,
Play at Shea.
Yeah.
Do you think you did well?
Yeah, that was good. They were both good shows. The last double play at Shea, we did the two nights.
Yeah.
Yes, that was exhilarating. It was a hometown crowd, and it was exhilarating. We were on stage for 3.5 hours, and I didn't realize how hot it was. It was sweating. I'm watching the movie of me on stage. Somebody give that guy a towel.
Yeah, it was hot.
He's like soaking. Ugh, he's so wet and slimy. Wipe him off. We were having such a good time. We walked off, and for weeks after, we were kind of amping from it.
New York loves you.
I know. And I love New York. That's why I live here.
I love you.
But I put away the recording part of my career, and I put away, for the time being, performing.
What's that music?
That's my telephone.
Is it phone? Yeah.
You hear it? It's The Godfather.
It's the theme from The Godfather. Is your ringtone on your phone?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well,
I got to think about what my ringtone should be.
Guys on the road call me Godfather.
Do that?
Why do you come to me?
Bonacera. Bonacera. What have I ever done?
Why do you hurt me?
You disrespect me this way.
Why do you hurt me?
You never invite me to your house for a cup of coffee.
Do you appreciate who you are? People love you. They adore you. You are so talented. You are so, like, it makes me want to choke up how talented you are. Do you know you are?
I know I have a talent for music. I don't think I'm all that good. I think I have a good perspective on it. I can separate the star stuff from the musician stuff.
Right.
The music is really important.
They have to
me.
Stay separate, don't they?
Well, one is a job, and one is a life.
Yeah.
The job thing I can take off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the rock star thing. I go shopping, I cook my own food, I wash the dishes, I take out the garbage. I know who that guy is. And the music has nothing to do with money or career. It's just part of me. It's like love. Music, love, food, friendship, my daughter, you know, all these great things.
How's your daughter doing?
She's great. You know, I know how to take the job hat off and just kind of be normal. It took a long time to separate them out, okay? I can be a musician and not be a rock star. You know, I'm still trying to convince people, I'm not a rock star. And then, no, yes, you are. You are a rock star. You're a star. I said, oh, okay, fine. But a lot of that has a job aspect to it. I work very hard at writing because that's my deepest love. I think that's really where I belong. The rock star thing I've never really been comfortable with because I don't think I look like a rock star. I didn't really set out to be a rock star. I became a rock star serendipitously.
Right. You became a rock star in spite of yourself.
In spite of myself.
In spite of yourself.
Which is hysterical
as hard
to me.
As much as you tried to kill it.
Yeah, I mean, I did.
Don't put that camera too close to me.
Exactly. I don't want to make a good video. Let me make a bad video. Yeah. I don't want to be in a photo session. I hate taking pictures. I don't want to go to this opening. I don't want to go to that schmooze fest. I just didn't do any of that stuff. But I'm comfortable with it now.
Do me a favor. What's a song that you think to yourself, you know, I really still enjoy hearing that song? It doesn't have to be a hit. What's one you dislike that you haven't played, that you really, really like?
I've been doing master classes at colleges, And I get to play all these obscure songs. Played one the other night, and I said, well, really, wow, that's a really good song. There's no rhyme. Not until the very end is when a rhyme comes in, but the lyrics work. It's from the Nylon Curtain, and it's called Where's the Orchestra?
Where's the orchestra? Wasn't this supposed to be a musical? Here I am in the balcony. How the hell could I have missed the overture? I like the scenery, even though I have absolutely no idea at all.
Billy Joel says he doesn't look back on his life that much. Last year, he decided not to publish his long-awaited memoir entitled The Book of Joel. He said instead, quote, the best expression of my life and its ups and downs has been and remains my music, unquote. For an extended version of my interview with Billy Joel, listen to our podcast at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is produced by Emily Botine and Kathy Russo, with support from Jim Briggs, Brian Cosgrove, Ed Herbstman, Melanie Hoops, and Monica Hopkins. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. You're the king.
Thank you.
No, really, you're the king, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks, man.